Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight to hear Diana Wyndham talk about her most recent book, Norman Hare and the Study of Sex. I'll introduce our speaker briefly. After completing a PhD in history from the University of Sydney, Diana Wyndham was awarded a Norman Hare Fellowship from the University's Faculty of Medicine in 1998. Her books include Populate and Perish, Australian Women's Fight for Birth Control, which was co-authored, and Eugenics in Australia, Striving for National Fitness, which was published in 2003, and of course, more recently, Norman Hare and the Study of Sex. And tonight, we are going to have a talk on, someone's taken my program notes, Studying Sex in the early 20th Century, Norman Hare. Diana Wyndham, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you very much for coming. My talk is about Norman Hare, a freethinker who campaigned for contraception, sexology and human rights. Philip Adams said he should be called Saint Norman and put back on his pedestal. Michael Kirby believes the story would make a fascinating film. In the foreword of my book, Kirby praised Hare as a flamboyant, shy and outrageous hero who battled against deception and religious conservatism in a bid to empower women and dispel sexual misery. Others have tried to discredit him. Norman Zions, as he was known for the first 27 years of his life, was born in Paddington, Sydney, on the 21st of January, 1892, as Henry and Clara Zions' unplanned and unwanted 11th and final child. Henry was 51 and Clara was 40. His parents were Jewish, and Henry's surname was originally spelled Z-A-J-A-C, Polish for hair. It is pronounced in Polish as Zions. So Henry changed it to Zions when he fled from Poland to England. Norman feared and hated his father, but loved his overprotective mother. Norman was a very bright child, but he was also short-sighted, timid and delicate, and bullies tormented him in primary school. Fortunately, he blossomed in Fort Street, at Sydney's Fort Street High School, and he starred in the school's literary and debating society. After school hours, an elocution teacher gave him free training, and in exchange, Norman gave recitals to advertise her teaching. Norman had two ambitions. He wanted to be an actor, and, prompted by his chance discovery of Havelock Ellis's Studies of the Psychology of Sex in Sydney's Public Library, he also wanted to devote his life to saving the world from sexual misery, to repay the debt he felt he owed to Havelock Ellis. After he left school, a theatrical agent offered him a job. This sparked a melodrama at home. His father threatened to throw him out of the house if he didn't become a medical student, and his mother begged him on her knees not to be an actor. Reluctantly, Norman enrolled in medicine at Sydney University, but he became more interested when he started to see patients. He also spent five nights a week rehearsing, acting or reciting at concerts and took part in a university commemoration day procession. Norman actually was the one who had his head in a bag. In 1914, he was judged the best amateur reciter in Australia at the Ballarat Estedford. Years later, Dame Enid Lyons found his voice the most beautiful she had ever heard, surpassing that of Shakespearean actor Sir John Gielgud, and I quote, whose voice is famous for the music of its tones, unquote. Zions again begged for acting work, but the agent said, graduate first. When he graduated in March 1915, he rushed to the agent to claim his promise, but this time he was refused because doctors were needed in the war. Norman took various hospital jobs and, in addition, from 1915 to 1919, he worked part-time as an army captain at the Randwick Military Hospital. He later said these were the unhappiest years of his life. Perhaps he used food as a solace. He was slim when he posed for this 1916 picture with three of his siblings, but 2 years later he had become portly and his weight remained a problem all his life. Oscar Levant said he knew Doris Day before she was a virgin. Similarly, this episode concerned Norman Zions before he became Norman Hare, a Newcastle hospital before it became Royal Newcastle. It began in January 1918 when the unsuspecting 26-year-old from Sydney became the medical superintendent of a hospital which had no isolation facilities, huge debts, pigeons in the roof and rats in the kitchen. As well, the doctors lived in fear of the board which had summarily dismissed Zion's predecessor. Catastrophe struck during the influenza pandemic. A seaman died at the hospital and the board, who had initially praised his administrative skill, blamed Zion's. After this shattering blow, he left Australia, changed his name to Norman Zions, to Norman Hare, as I said before, Hare was Polish meaning of Zions, and started afresh. When he arrived in London in December 1919, he was poor and unknown, but he quickly established himself with help from Havelock Ellis, who introduced him to key figures in birth control, eugenics and sexology. In 1921, Hare became the honorary medical officer at the Malthusian League's Free Birth Control Clinic, which provided poor women with contraceptives, including Hare's pessary. The following year, he invited medical practitioners and students to attend the League's historic conference, the first international conference on birth control, which was held in London, where he played a key role. Hare later said that many doctors had begged for their names to be kept secret when they wrote for tickets, but on learning that Lord Dawson of Penn and Sir Arthur Lane would attend, they became braver. Hare found two lucrative ways to support his voluntary work. He used artificial insemination to help provide aristocrats with heirs, and from 1922 he performed, in quotes, rejuvenations. Scientists claimed that glandular innovations were the key to eternal youth, and Hare performed the vasectomy procedure promoted by Eugene Steinach, wrote a book about it, and used the fees to fund his charitable work. Hare rejuvenated around 200 artistic and intellectual men, including W.B. Yeats. Now Hare's income was secure, he concentrated on birth control in order to empower women by giving them birth-bearing choices. He broke new ground in July 1923 and startled the conservative medical profession when he presented the key paper at a contraception symposium. 40 years later, Sir John Peel, the Queen's gynaecologist, praised Hare's excellent paper, saying it was based on wide practical experience, but ridiculed others by, quote, distinguished gynaecologists and obstetricians who equated contraception with masturbation and said both caused sterility or insanity in subsequent offspring. Following the success of the symposium, Hare travelled to Berlin to meet Magnus Hirschfeld, a homosexual Jewish socialist sexology. Hare admired him and studied at his Institute for Sexual Research, and the two worked collaboratively for the next decade. Hare's 1924 diary was filled with meetings, dinners, rehearsals and lectures, including an address to Cambridge University's Heretics Club, the intellectual snob society of the day. Hare also starred at Oxford, and the university's official history called him the most illustrious speaking at the St. John's Essay Society, noting that his three-hour and comprehensive exposition received intensive and appreciative attention from an audience that was the largest in the society's records. In 1925, he had his portrait painted, and Margaret Sanger praised our friend Norman Hare, who in his quietly effective manner stressed the need for birth control for the good of humanity and the nation. A journalist praised him for his valuable works on sex psychology and noted that he had become a Harley Street specialist in his early 30s. It was amazing that a radical young Jewish doctor who was an outsider could flourish in this conservative medical enclave. Hare was chosen as the British delegate at the 6th International Birth Control Conference in New York and addressed nearly 1,000 doctors who agreed with his recommendation that birth control should be taught in medical schools. In 1926, he presented a paper in German at the first International Congress for Sexual Research in Berlin. His achievements were really remarkable at a time when the House of Commons refused to discuss the possibility of public spending on birth control information, even for married women, and the Times published letters of complaint after the words birth control had been used in a late-night radio debate. The BBC promised it would not happen again. In 1927, Hare acted in Ivor Montague's silent film Blue Bottles, and in a debate on sexual reform, this Hare was the tall one on the right, and in a debate on sexual reform versus birth control, Hare, who advocated both, clashed with G.K. Chesterton, who opposed both. Hare was now rich enough to buy the lease of 127 Harley Street and furnish it elaborately. He sent a postcard of his huge bed to friends as a greeting or an invitation. He had a butler, cook, maids, secretaries and a nursing sister. Patients went by lift to the top floor consulting rooms. His chauffeur and Rolls-Royce were stationed in a mews behind the house. He was writing Hymen or The Future of Marriage. The title means either the Greek god of marriage or something earthier when spelt with lowercase. His mother came to stay with him and conceded, "Perhaps you were right after all. It is a pity I did not meet you a year or two before you were born." Hare did not want to abolish sexual morality, but argued, "Just as a piano needs tuning so that it may give the sweetest music, our sexual morality needs readjustment to make life as harmoniously as possible." He prophesied that in the future contraception would be used by all normal people and observed that although parents educate their children and supervise their eating, they try to keep them ignorant about sex matters. He also said it was better for a child to be brought up with only one parent than with two parents who are always quarrelling with each other. Remember, he said this in 1927. One reviewer said Hare was as lucid as he is bold, but another called it a hideous picture of a godless future and said a kick from a mule is stimulating and so are some parts of Hymen, but it is not cheerful reading. It would not inspire a knight to do great deeds for his lady love. Hare had launched his own birth control clinic for the poor, where doctors gave free advice to all women whose health or other circumstances made it advisable. In contrast, Australian family planning clinics would only treat married women until the 1970s. The mural in Hare's clinic had this slogan, There was an old woman who lived in a shoe. She had so many children, she didn't know what to do. Don't be like her. Ask the doctor for birth control advice. In 1928, Hare attended the Congress in Copenhagen, from which the World League for Sexual Reform, WLSR, was born, the child of Magnus Hirschfeld. Hare agreed to be the secretary of the Congress, and the League decided to hold it in London the following year. Dora Russell became the treasurer, and together they organised a successful event. Hare and Russell faced fierce opposition, but gained support from respected names and raised enough money to hire the Wigmore Hall for a whole week. A reviewer noted the delegates' energy, enthusiasm and courage, and praised Hare for his tireless and tactful work and his lucid, forcible speeches. Edmund Capp's caricature showed Hare's main interests: acting, eating and teaching people how to make a sex omelette. It was impossible to achieve the League's utopian aims, but the Congress had broken many taboos on marriage, divorce, censorship, sex education, birth control, abortion, prostitution and VD. One speaker was a feisty author called Ethel Mannon, who admired Hare's rationalism and his rational dress. Unfortunately, the knickerbockers aren't such a good look, but he tried. He later invited her to dinner to meet his patient, W.B. Yeats. She was asked to wear her most alluring evening dress to see if Yeats' rejuvenation was successful. It was. At the WLSR Congress in Vienna in 1930, Hare and Hirschfeld became co-presidents. Hare sent Havelock Ellis the details and mentioned an address in German he would be giving in Berlin in 1931. His language skills and stage training proved invaluable. Hare became seriously ill with rheumatic fever in 1932, but despite this, he gave two important presentations in French. He addressed France's president and senior ministers in Paris on the 24th of June. 3 days later, he warned three new sexological societies to expect a curious phenomenon when they announced their research. If they said that the Earth was flat, people would attack their scientific thinking. And if they said that influenza was caused by solar spots, people would doubt their medical ability. But none would claim you hit your mother or are part of the white slave trade or have 10 wives and 20 mistresses or that you sleep with a camel. However, if they said that prostitution should be regulated or abolished or made free, or that contraception should be permitted or punished, everyone would accuse them of being Bluebeard or the Marquis de Sade or Child of Sodom. In the sexual domain, people expressing conclusions faced violent and vile accusations, and he exhorted them to have courage, courage, always more courage. The WLSR 1932 Congress in Brno, Czechoslovakia, was the last Congress. That is Hare on my right, Hirschfeld in the middle, and Gies, the secretary of Hirschfeld, is the other person. In 1932, Hare attended the birth control conference in Washington, and Margaret Sanger also thanked him for his splendid presentation in New York. He told her it would be his last conference. Conferences are for the young. We older people, I was 42 last week, can do more by reporting our results at our other meetings or by publishing them in full detail. Soon Hare's world began to unravel. He was restoring a country house and his debts were mounting when he became ill and could only work part-time. In 1932, he was shattered by the death of one of his patients in childbirth. She was Conchita Suburbia, a talented opera singer. The architect, Sir Edwin Lichens, designed her tomb, which was carved by the sculptor, Sir William Dick Reed. Perhaps in an attempt to show that all was well, Hare commissioned Tennyson Cole to paint his portrait and persuaded Havelock Ellis to have his done and asked him to come and see the results at Nettleton Lodge. He also gave visitors a map so they could get there without too much trouble. In May 1940, Hare obtained a permit from Britain on the grounds of ill health and an exit permit from Britain on the grounds of ill health and sailed for Australia. British security agents sent the first of about 40 confidential surveillance reports from London to Australia's Prime Minister's department, reporting that Hare was sailing on to Sydney on the SS Strathallan. The report continued, "Information suggests that Hare is a secret member of the Communist Party, and in addition he is president of the Sex Education Society, which has close connections with extreme political elements." Despite it being the most dangerous phase of the war, British and Australian authorities diverted extensive resources to monitor Hare's movement. A cable alerted all Australian states to watch for Dr. Hare when he landed in Sydney. Investigating officers met the Strathallan, but found no trace of him. This is not surprising because he had arrived in Perth on the Melbourne Star. An investigating officer said Hare had a decidedly foreign and Jewish appearance. In contrast, Smith's Weekly found him a tall, forceful, rather rakish-looking and originally dressed gynaecologist, a brilliant research worker in sexology and war's most picturesque gift to Australia to date. Hare expected to become an invalid or die, but his health improved with the help of insulin to control his diabetes. He had a flat at No. 7 Elizabeth Street and practised at 193 Macquarie Street. In 1941, a Sydney newspaper proprietor made the brave but lucrative decision to start a sexual advice column in the magazine Woman. They chose Hare, who had the pseudonym Dr. Wickham Terrace, a play on Brisbane's equivalent of Macquarie Street, and discussed topics such as sex education and venereal disease. He wrote more than 400 articles. Peter Coleman, a long time ago, called Hare one of Australia's most famous freethinkers and sex reformers, and said his column was probably the most freethinking series of articles ever written for a mass circulation magazine. Despite Hare's Jewish ancestry, in 1942, two military police officers visited him after receiving an allegation that he was a German and his real name was von something or other. He was alarmed because under the national security regulations, anybody could be arrested and interred for long periods without cause. The Deputy Director of Security for New South Wales advised his counterpart in Canberra that although they could not place a restriction order on Hare, they had taken informal steps to curb his future actions. A week later, G.R. Boren from the Catholic Chemist Guild sent this telegram to Arthur Calwell, the Minister for Immigration, mentioning Jack Holloway, the Minister for Health. And I'll read it out because it's a bit blurry. "Sex," this is the name of one of the publications, "Sex Problems of Today by Norman Hare. Stop. Angus and Robertson Publishers. Stop. Price 2 and 6. Stop. Rotten. Stop. Can Holloway stop it? Stop." Copy following. Lauren. Despite this controversy, in August 1944, top management of the Australian Broadcasting Commission bravely chose Hare to be the key speaker in a radio debate on population. Complaints began before the broadcast, including this telegram sent on behalf of Moore College, Theological College's Public Morals Committee to Prime Minister Curtin. Quote, "Strongly oppose Dr. Norman Hare speaking over National Network on Birth Rate Question Wednesday. Refer you to his published writings on subject. Also New South Wales Government's police report of his sex lectures here." Curtin withstood both Anglican and Roman Catholic opposition, but this debate became the ABC's largest controversy during the war. The photograph shows Jessie Street speaking from notes, Enid Lyons facing her, and Norman Hare wearing a bow tie. Thomas Challen drew a caricature showing Hare as a hare, opposite Lyons with the crucifix in her hand, surrounded by 11 koala-faced children. And Hare is saying, "My dear dame, prevention is better than curette." And Lyons is saying, "My dear doctor, a letter is better than a letter." The fourth speaker, economist Colin Clark, was meant to provide facts and figures. Instead, he delivered a tirade about the perversion of preventing childbirth by unnatural practices, which were, quote, filthy, vicious and disgusting. In response, Hare said Clark's views were determined by peculiar religious superstition. Hare said that his mother had become irritable and prematurely old as a result of her excessive and uncontrolled fertility. For all that she got out, he really lost it here, and said, for all that she got out of life, she might have as well have been a prize cow. Politicians said nothing about Clark's offensive remarks, but denounced Hare in Parliament, and behind the scenes, sabotage attempts climaxed in a court case on the 22nd of March 1945. A trumped-up assault charge was used to discredit Hare, and Ezra Norton, the proprietor of Truth, gleefully reported the case. Hare left Australia on the 24th of August 1946 and never returned. As a young man, Hare wanted to sit at the feet of others, but he gained confidence, courage and stability in the 1920s once he started his stable, secret relationship with a calm, scholarly older man. He was Willem van der Haak, the administrator of the Rotterdam Zoo, who provided the wisdom, serenity and support which enabled Hare to wring out his old unhappy past and ring in his new one as a crusader, and he emphasised this in his season's greeting card. Hare wanted to uplift humanity, providing a new sexual ethic which would reflect scientific knowledge and social and economic circumstances rather than an outworn biblical ethic. Hare told his good friend, Paddy O'Connor, that he was going to leave his money to the University of Sydney for the study of sex to annoy the Wowsers. Hare died in 1952, and George Molnar's cartoon, in response to the news of the terms of the bequest, was shown. He's showing the canoodling students at the front asking, "And when will we get the money?" This flamboyant, shy and outrageous hero deserves recognition. Thank you.
So we come to questions and discussion. Many thanks for that. And Diana Wyndham's book, Norman Hare and the Study of Sex, Janet Grundy's got some copies outside, and I'm sure Dr. Wyndham would be happy to sign one later. Just starting off, we've got plenty of time. You spoke about Dr. Hare's political attitudes briefly. You said there was some suggestion that he may have had some left-wing connections. Did he have any political views? Did he state any political views? We just come up here and talk to the back of the room. Yeah.
I think in the 20s that it was very common for the intelligentsia to have left-wing leanings, and he did, and he actually said in the debate with Chesterton that he was a socialist, and his debate had been all very lively until he then came up with the political jargon, and he became so flat, the party line. But he very soon he decided that being quiet about his politics or having none was the safest way. I think he was realising that with the 1930s to be homosexual, Jewish, and a socialist was not a good thing to be.
So did he ever join the Communist Party?
I have asked for the British Communist Party that, and they said they had no records. The 18-page of his speech in France was kept in the University of Manchester, the archives of the Communist Party. So all I can say is they had no records, but I don't think it was likely.
You just stay here.
You've done work on eugenics, and what we've all forgotten about is that if you go back into the early 20th century, the left were in favour of notions of racial purity, or certainly the idea of eugenics. And I think the Russells dabbled in it a bit too. It wasn't just a right-wing thing. It was very much a sort of, let's try and improve humanity and whatever. Was he in any way involved in that kind of work in terms of music? Can you explain how and where?
At that time, as you've said, that after the Industrial Revolution, where people felt that they had improved machines, the next stage was to try and make better people to live in this improved age. But by today's standards, some of the things that Hare said were very outrageous. He thought that people who were not who didn't wish to be children have children shouldn't, but also some who thought that were undesirable parents should be given by the government a no baby bonus. So he definitely when the Eugenics Society was trying to have a laws passed about voluntary sterilisation, he and Havelock Ellis were very against that because they thought that it was a medical procedure and should be left without any law.
Peter Coleman.
Thank you. Dr. Windham, you mentioned Ethel Mann and left-wing radical feminist emerged in some celebrity in the 1920s. What's always puzzled me is that in her book on her golden years in the 1920s, she spoke so warmly of Norman Hare. But when she revisited the 20s some 40 or 50 years later in another memoir, she spoke of him as a monster, a coward, a glutton, a Caliban. Well, everybody changes his mind in the course of 50 years, but what motivated Ethel Mannon, do you know, to so totally change her view of him?
Question, just to repeat, in case it wasn't picked up, just what motivated Ethel Mannon to change her view of Hare?
Ethel Mannon was a person whose views changed enormously, and I think what might have prompted it, she wrote a book which Hare reviewed, and he said that she'd been through so many isms she didn't quite know what what her political views were at the moment, but she might be muddled, but whatever she said was always interesting. So I think that might have been what made her decide that she didn't care for him. But she was
a
very...
She called him a coward and a glutton and a monster.
Oh, well, look, she was a very sort of...
That's what she was like.
His... She blew hot and cold about various people that she'd had been had a bad relationship with W.B. Yeats, and then said the same sorts of things about him.
Question.
Yes, I get the impression that in the United 30s in Australia there was a fair bit of birth control for the middle classes.
In the 1930s, no, I don't think so. When the Racial Hygiene Association set itself up in 1926, they had to call themselves that because at that stage in Sydney, at that stage, birth control was so much of a taboo subject. Eugenics was okay, so they called it Racial Hygiene Association, so that under that umbrella they could then give a little bit of birth control to women whose pregnancies might not end happily, as they put it. So it was difficult.
So just tell us a bit about here. I mean, there's a suggestion that Ethel Manon said he was horrible. I mean, what was his personality like? Was he a pleasant person? Was he a difficult person? Did he have many friends? Or
he had. He was a person who was charismatic. He was a person who polarised people. There were some people who absolutely loved him and some people who detested him. The people who detested him were the ones who didn't like his outspokenness about sexuality, and the people who were the warm supporters were the ones who he was a very well-educated, witty, charismatic sort of man, and but he was very tall, and he really called a spade, and that was something which annoyed some people.
And when was his homosexuality well known?
No, it was, he had to keep it secret.
Not even among his friends?
Oh, it was something which was known about by his colleagues, but something that they didn't speak about. I mean, there were things where those that knew, like his pictures of his bed, which was big enough for three, that he sent out as greeting cards or invitations.
He was a three in a bed man, was he?
I don't know.
Well, there's a question in the front here, yes.
This man is incredibly impressive. I wonder if you could hypothesise for us why somebody who was so terrific at seeing the importance of sexual health for people, of the availability of contraception, then has to be up against what seems to have occurred historically, political opposition to health for people.
I think that whole climate was terribly conservative. As an example, in London, the Times wouldn't put any information about people such as Hare or Murray Stokes, what they were doing, but they delighted in writing their obituaries when they were dead. It just was the little comment I made about how the BBC had to grovel to apologise in 1927 for the terrible words birth control having been spoken. It's hard for us to comprehend just how really difficult it was for people to get contraception that was safe and that worked.
So were his clients, the wealthy women of London, shall we say, or were they clinics of people who of great disadvantage?
In Harley Street, that he did have people who were wealthy, and he was once called the Robin Hood of Harley Street, because he charged 100 guineas for a confinement, which was a huge amount of money. But that was he used the income he got from that and from his rejuvenation operations to have free birth control clinics, and to also to do his publications and go and give his conferences papers. When he was writing for Woman, Elizabeth Riddell, who I had the good fortune to go and spend a day with, he said that in the 1940s they paid him peanuts, but he didn't care. He just wanted to make his get his messages out.
There's a question here. Yeah.
Just going back to the birth control of the 20s that you're talking
Let's
about.
Speak up a bit.
Yeah. Just going back to the birth control of the 1920s you were talking about in England, does that show that the church had a great influence over the government, the society at that time, or was it more the government?
The church did have a great influence, and even in the 1940s, in Britain, there was a proposal to have vending machines outside pharmacy shops when the shops were shut. And the Archbishop of Canterbury came out and said, you know, the sky was going to fall if this would happen. And because Hare wasn't able to get any response in letters published, he had his own the Journal of Sex Education, so he published all those things himself.
And just a further one to that, what was Hare's view in regard to religion?
What was Hare's view in regard to religion? Did he have religious views?
He didn't talk about religion, but he really had that sort of Jewish way of trying to make the world a better place. But he certainly, most of the people he had head-on clashes were people who were religious. And when he was in the later years in Australia, when he was getting a lot of heckling, he spoke for WEA a lot of times and gave lectures up in Newcastle. And one time the things that were published in the papers that he had said, he really was very sort of intemperate in his attacks. But, you know, he really had been goaded a lot first.
Stuart?
His relationship with the zoologist, was that just in Europe, or did that keep on going when he came to Australia? And I think if I've got you right, he was born in 1892 and died in the 1950s.
52,
very
yeah.
young. What did he die of?
So there's a question about his relationship with the zoologist, and he dies at the age of, what, 60?
60.
So what did he die of?
Okay. He had had... he was very fat. He was overweight. He had had... he had got rheumatic fever, and then he also had diabetes, which when he was in England wasn't controlled, that his specialist for some reason said he shouldn't use insulin. He'd also had a heart attack. So it was a combination of all of these things. He was on a lecture tour in the States. He wanted particularly to meet Kinsey, and he had his 60th birthday there, but he was just suffering from heart failure, and he had to abandon the lecture tour and come home, and he died in hospital 6 weeks after he got back.
And buried where?
Buried in, cremated and buried in London.
Okay, so there was a question about the zoologist.
The relationship with the zoologist.
The Rotterdam Zoo man?
Yes.
That is very shadowy. I only knew about that from looking at Hare's will, where he left the bulk of his estate to Sydney University for the study of sex. He left, I think it was about £5,000 to his partner, but there was also a shared bank vault that had another £8,000, which was between Willem and Norman. And Willem went and talked to the solicitors at Sydney University and said he would let them have seven of those $8,000. Yeah. And he was... Hare died when he was 62, and at that stage Willem was 72, and the only one I have is that picture. And there was also there was some movie cameras that Hare was a great Super 8 photographer, and there was a picture of a very dapper looking chap in a white suit coming down a slope, which I thought could have been Willem, but I'm not sure.
Okay, so
following on what I said before about birth control in the 30s, I was born in 1920. Okay, now my grandmother had 8 children. Next generation of our family, no one had more than 1 or 2 children, and everybody we visited had 1 or 2 children. And so somebody must have been using condoms or doing something, because it just wasn't. Very large families were not anywhere I could see, except with really poor people.
The suggestion is that very
Catholics.
Very large families were ceasing to exist by the 1940s, is what you're saying, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think a lot of men got sent to the back veranda to sleep after there was also coitus interruptus, and there were huge numbers of backyard abortions too that Hare talked about when he was little. He didn't realise the significance until he was a little older, but his mother was always sending him to the chemist to get boxes of pills, and he realised afterwards that it was, they were strong laxatives to try and bring on the pills.
Okay, right.
Oh, condoms were there, yes. Yes,
okay.
They would use condoms, yes.
So, that was your point, I think, wasn't it?
Well, maybe they were better. Maybe
so there was a form of birth control, but...
It's possible, technically,
okay.
Sort of
proven. Okay. You want to add to that?
Hare, when he came to Australia, did talk about the sale of contraception, and he said it was almost as if it was like a sly grog shop trying to get contraception, and also he said that they were priced like about 10 times more than they were in Britain. So it was, you had to have enough money to be able... You had to know where to go, and you had to have enough money to be able to pay for them, too.
Peter Coleman?
Thank you. Despite his frequent criticisms of the Catholic Church and his public confrontations with Dame Edith Lyons, who was a very conservative Catholic lady, she... spoke well of him, not just that it's a beautiful speaking voice, but more generally about him. What spell did he cast over the day needed, or was he a man of great charm?
So just for those who missed it, the Catholic politician, Damien and Lyons, spoke very well of him, despite they disagreed on some issues. So was he just a charming man, or where did her position come from?
I think she was a very liberal woman. I think that when she first was going to talk, she had she'd agreed ahead of time. McMahon Ball, he'd asked her to speak, and
McMahon Ball was working for the ABC, right?
Yes. Okay, and at the last minute, friends of her husband were trying to say, no, you shouldn't. This, that and the other, and she thought, well, she had agreed and she trusted McMahon Ball, so she would talk. And then when she met him, she said that he really was, apart from being his bulk offended her, she thought that was awful, but he said that the voice was so beautiful that he had the audience in the palm of his hands until the moment of when he talked about his mother. And then, that was that when he got angry and spoke that way, and that he really blew it.
They would be friends of her,
Damien
and Lyons' late husband, because Joe's
dated 39. She was a widow, yes.
Family. So tell us about his. It always seems a bit unreasonable to me. Criticise your mother for not practising birth control. I've never quite...
No. He said that he was very sad that she was such a vital young woman, and that he talked about her health having been ruined by 16 years of continuous birth and breastfeeding and
described
childbearing.
Her when he went off. She described him as a cow. He described her as a cow.
Well, the joy she got out of life was no more than it would have been if she had been a cow, which is a very unfortunate thing to have
but
said.
But if she hadn't been a cow, he wouldn't have been there. No. So.
True. But he was very, very sort of emotionally attached to her. And I just
want to ask about him leaving London. On that Ethel Manning thing, she put around a story that he ran away and was scared.
Yes.
His Jewish background was one of the features in what he was running from, because everyone was worried that Germany was going to invade Britain.
Yes.
Now, to what extent did the conditions of the war at the time force him to take a dangerous journey as it was,
yes,
because the ships being bombed, to come back to Australia? Was he running from a possible, being caught up in the anti-Semitic campaigns that might have come to Britain, or was he getting away from, unpleasant things in the medical world?
He did offer his services to the medical profession before war broke out, but he said because of his health that he could only do things like being an anaesthetist and things, because he couldn't work full-time because his health might break down. But to try and really read into what his motives were, he really did think he was dying, so he must have thought, I would think to die at home might be a better thing. But some of the things that Ethel Mallon said about him were clearly not true. She said about, oh, his friend said he was a shaking, I believe, when he left. But then when he did go, he had to get permission to go. And you didn't know until the 12 hours before you were able to go on the boat that you had got permission to go. But as well as that, he had to go up Manchester and sail from there so that there would be nobody on the dock to see whether he was shaking like a leaf or seeing him off at all. But and Hare was so sort of this... Hare was so hurt about this that he had a solicitor say, look, these are part of the vicious lies that are being said about me, and this is what really happened.
So we're getting towards the end now. Stuart?
Hirschfeld in Germany, what happened to him under the Nazis? And also, what was Hare's relationship like with the Bloomsbury set? Was it sexual, was it artistic, or was it professional?
So what happened to Dr. Hirschfeld, and what was Hare's relationship with the Bloomsbury set?
Hirschfeld was beaten up badly by the Nazi thugs right in the from the 20s twice and almost killed, and in he fled from Berlin in 1933 and lived in exile in various other countries, and he died in Nice in 1935. He died of he too had diabetes, but he died there. I think it was a stroke, but I'm not sure. And the second
the Bloomsbury Group, did he get it off with the Bloomsbury Group, I think is the question. I mean, were they in the bed?
He did know the movers and shakers, and I'm just trying to think of
Aldous Huxley.
Yeah, he did a
Strachey?
He did.
How
a,
did he know them?
Well, Aldous Huxley did a foreword for his book on contraception, but he was very much involved with all of the people who were into literature and the arts.
Okay, but I think we're getting close. Can I just ask a final question? I mean, it seems to me that what he left is £20,000, and is that what you've been working off as a Norman Hare Fellow?
I haven't used it all up,
but just so he's still... He may not have had any offspring, but he's had a sort of an ongoing influence. So why did you write this book, and are you going to do any other work in this kind of area?
There was a previous person who, Frank Foster, a gynaecologist from Melbourne in the 70s, took the Hare Fellowship to write the biography, and... For the last 20 years of his life, he said he was too sick to write it. But he also said that Hare, he couldn't find a publisher, and that people got cold, turned away from him, and talk about solicitors, and that's why he hadn't done it. And in 1995, this man died. So by that time, I was beginning to really feel that people he had been bad-mouthing Hare. So I then put the facts to the people who gave out the fellowship and said, look, the person who did it said he would do it 20 years ago, didn't, and is now dead. I think I'd be very well placed to write it. So having one person who let him down, I felt when I started, I really had to finish.
Well, I'm very pleased that you did. So many thanks. Just take it away. So many thanks to Diana Wyndham for a very entertaining and important address about a very significant man, as Peter Coleman pointed out some time ago, one of probably the leading free thinkers in Australia of his generation. As I said, there are copies of Dr. Wyndham's book, Norman Hare and the Study of Sex Outside. It's been a very reflective view of Australia of a certain generation now. Seems a long time ago to many of us now, but a very important part of Australian life. Thanks for coming here tonight, and best wishes for your next work. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.